You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions Special.
Episode
9.
And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
The Tricorder Transmissions is back again with our 9th supplemental log episode. This time, we'll be having an in-depth discussion about the second season Trek episode, Journey to Babel, focusing specifically on new alien races and concepts introduced in that episode. To help us, we've assembled a panel of some of our favorite returning guests, including two actors from Star Trek The Experience, and our resident DS9/Enterprise expert, along with Craig and myself. So we're happy to welcome back to the show, Mr. Vernon Wilmer. How's it going, Vernon?
Fine.
Great to have you back on the show. How's things out in Vegas?
It's perfect weather right now. We're right in between severe winter and absolute hell. Thanks for asking.
Nice. What temperature would that be for everybody in our listening audience?
81 degrees.
Wow.
Oh, beautiful.
And that's a dry heat, right?
That is correct. For now, it is, yes, dry.
Awesome. We also have with us the wonderful April A. Bear. How are you, April?
Hello, gentlemen. I am fine. How are you guys?
Yeah, very good, April. Always good to hear from you.
Always.
Oh, well, I love to hang out with you and geek out.
And our resident DS9 and all other sorts of Star Trek things expert, Mr. Chris Ritzer. How are you, Chris?
Doing good. Thanks once again for having me on.
Oh, always a pleasure. And our infamous co-host, Mr. Craig Cohen.
Yeah, this is, you know, we've got like a super panel tonight. This is amazing.
This is a Tricorder Transmissions first. We've never had this many people on a show before.
I just feel like I'm in the presence of greatness.
Your own greatness.
Well, I'm always in that presence.
So, April, did you have something you wanted to touch on before we got started?
Yes, I just wanted to give a little tribute to Clay Wardlow, and he was one of the many fans that came to Star Trek The Experience over the years. He loved it. He came to the conventions every year, and he was just a really sweet, wonderful guy. He passed away from colon cancer on May 2nd, and what's so tragic about that is he was only 37 years old. Oh, I know. It was very quick, about a year and a half, and he really fought it, but he loved Trek so much. The entire time he was ill, you know, he would wear his costume. He still went to conventions. He really tried everything. I would love to send you guys a picture of him. Maybe you can post it on your page or something.
Absolutely.
But just, I want to shout out to all his friends and family and to his Trek friends who stood by him the whole time. He really was a personal hero of mine, and I got to tell him that. He really fought hard against cancer, but he never let it change who he was. And I think a lot of people are going to miss him. So rest in peace, Clay. You were a great Trek fan. Yeah, very sad.
Sincerest condolences from the Tricorder Transmissions crew to his family and friends. I'm really sorry to hear about that.
Yeah, they'll be glad to know that you're thinking about him.
So once again, we are going to be talking a little bit more in depth about the Journey to Babel episode. Craig and I covered that in our most recent scene-specific commentary episode this past Sunday. So if you haven't listened to that yet, stop this episode, give that a listen, and then come back because we're going to add a lot more to that conversation that we've already brought up. So that episode is pretty famous for being a really universe-expanding episode of the original series, almost more so than a lot of the other episodes we've covered in the past. And that's because they bring in quite a few new alien races to the show that we haven't seen yet. And we get kind of a feeling of how many races are in Starfleet and how many races they come into contact with and have dealings with. So as a quick recap, in the Journey to Babel, the Enterprise comes under attack on the way to a diplomatic conference on the planet Babel. One of the alien dignitaries is murdered, and Spock's estranged father, Sarek, is the prime suspect. But he is also deathly ill, and only Spock can save him. So tons and tons of things at stake in this episode. So before we jump into specifics, I wanted to give everybody on the panel tonight a chance to talk a little bit about their feelings towards Journey to Babel and anything that they'd like to share with the audience. So, Vernon, you want to kick us off with what you think of the episode?
Oh, it's a fantastic episode. It it establishes the founding members of the Federation for the canon. You've got Tellarites and Andorians. There's mention made of the Corridans. And, of course, it establishes Sarek and Amanda. And there's a subplot with the Orion Syndicate. It is a very universe-expanding episode, one of the most important. Absolutely one of my favorites.
So, April, anything from you on this?
Well, I just think it's a great character-driven episode. We find out so much more about Spock's family, and we find out that Vulcan families are just as dysfunctional as any other. it did explain, you know, a little more about Vulcans and gave us, as Vernon said, a few hints about other alien races out there. Just a fashion note, apparently for women in the 23rd century, really high hair was the fashion. Because everybody has, you know, like Marge Simpson hair. It was crazy.
Amanda needed a building permit for that hairdo.
That's great. So a little bit of futuristic fashion tips for any of our female listeners out there. If you want to know what to wear in a couple of hundred years, you heard it here first.
Just start ratting your hair now so that in the 23rd century it will be that high.
Very
that
awesome.
That episode also gave us the blood pumping prop in sick bay that was seen there for the rest of the series.
Oh
yeah, good point. We hit on that in our commentary as a cue for the evidence of green blood. So you got to see the green blood pumping from Spock to Sarek in that scene. So pretty cool. I know we'd seen Spock have a little bit of green blood on him in a previous episode, but this is the first time we'd really seen any quantity.
Oh, yeah, and there's another standard Star Trek alien race made reference to in that episode, Rigelians, because they're talking about blood comparisons.
That's true. Right. Yeah, and Vulcans share some commonality with the Rigelians. Isn't that what they say?
Yeah, but it wasn't close enough, I think, was the problem.
Right. So, Mr. Craig Cohen, any thoughts on Journey to Babel in general?
I mean, just to expand upon, you know, our talk in the regular episode. I mean, for me, this episode really is one of the first times the series really felt bigger than it was and really delivered an episode unlike any other episode we had seen, even though it was a quote unquote bottle episode. Mm. And I think this is really one of those landmark episodes in terms of, you know, really changing the game, if you will, of the series and for the better, of course.
Mr. Chris Ritzer, any forward-looking thoughts on this episode? I know this builds a lot on what happens in future Trek series.
Yes, it's a big episode as far as Enterprise goes. Andorians pop up constantly there, and those are some of the best episodes in Trek, I think. You have some great acting by Jeffrey Combs as Shran, and it's just a fantastic episode. A ton of universe building. You get Sarek, who keeps popping up throughout the movies, and then Next Generation. It accomplishes a lot in a very short amount of time, which is really nice.
That is true.
I believe Enterprise did a two-parter that kind of expanded on those alien races and what they were going after also.
Yeah, we'll probably be touching on that once we get through our original series coverage. We're going to branch out and touch on a lot of the episodes that kind of build on what we learned in the original series. So that's a great lead-in for that. So in the Journey to Babel, we've already mentioned that we brought on a couple of major new alien races that we hadn't seen before. And the first one we're going to jump into is the Andorian race, and that's the blue guys with their little protruding antennae off the top of their head. So
that's April's cup of tea.
Did you get to save your props, April?
I can get dressed up right now if you want me to.
Oh, it's a shame we don't have video.
I've got everything.
Oh, yeah. So in the original script for Journey to Babel, Andorians are described as humanoids, tall and quite slim. If at all possible, the ears will be played down, taped back. But there are two delicately tapered antennae curling from the top of the head. Despite their almost fragile bodies, Andorians are a fierce warrior breed. Their dress indicates this to some extent and will include a vicious-looking bladed weapon, which I don't recall seeing on the episode, which is carried for use and not for ceremony. Andorians are pale blue. The script also states, habitually, because of the sensitive antennae, Andorians will listen with heads down and slightly tilted. Andorian voices are also different, soft, and whispering. So, any general thoughts?
They didn't show one of those blades until Shran had one in Enterprise. Somebody must have gone back and referenced that script.
Yeah, it's funny, Vernon. We've talked about on some of our commentaries on how much future Trek creators sort of cherry-picked a lot of little details that weren't hit upon in the original series. So that's a great little observation there.
Yeah, that episode definitely resonates on into the modern Trek series.
Yeah, for sure. I want to open up the floor to all of us here and to talk about any of our general impressions of Andorians. So, Chris Ritzer, what are your general thoughts on Andorians as a race?
Well, first, I think it was just really nice to see some new aliens that didn't just have pointy ears or a different kind of twirly mustache. It was definitely you could tell that they were at least attempting to expand what aliens were looking like. They weren't godlike or nothing, which was nice. And I think the best thing about them, the introduction, was what happened in Enterprise. You got a lot of good episodes there. And I believe they showed up in Next Generation as well, right?
Couple
appearances, background episode, like in the background, though, right?
Well, I think that Lol, doesn't she appear?
One of the episode Offspring.
That's right, yes.
Oh. And don't forget Star Trek IV at Starfleet headquarters.
Yes, sir. So, Vernon, let's just segue right into you. Thoughts on Andorians?
Oh, well, I thought they were a cool alien race for the original series. They had the classic, alien look for sci-fi with the antenna and a different colored skin and whatnot. They didn't really explore them, of course, until Enterprise, when they fleshed out the race and even gave us the subspecies, the Aenar. But before that, their mysteriousness is actually what made them compelling, almost the Boba Fett, if you will, of the Star Trek series. I just think they have a fascinating look. You know, whether they were mysterious on the old series or fleshed out in the modern series, just a compelling addition to the show. Right. And plus, two Andorians from Star Trek The Experience are two of my closest friends, so I have a biased opinion on Andorians.
As you probably should. Mr. Craig Cohen, thoughts on the Andorians?
Yeah, to sort of build upon what Vernon was just saying, the my biggest takeaway from them is, compared to the Klingons, who underwent quite a, you could almost say a radical transformation between series, the Andorians have held pretty firm in their look. And I guess that's a testament to the design and the thought that went into that race. And I also think it's neat that they're the race in Star Trek that a lot of casual fans of the series or, fringe watchers, they'll know they're those blue aliens with the antenna, but they won't know their names. So, I think right behind, Klingons and Vulcans, they're a pretty popular race. And, but they're the ones that people don't really know by name.
Good points. And I saved April for last because I know April played an Andorian at the Star Trek Experience.
I did. Well, let me just say that I kind of agree with a lot of things that you guys have said. Although we do see several Andorians in the episode, I don't think that we get a lot of information about who they are. I mean, we see them, we're introduced to them, but yeah, they are a little bit mysterious. The ambassador, the guy with the really distinct accent.
I can't remember his name. In fact, I don't think they ever say it in the episode.
Oh, that's possible.
But he reminds me of Jacques Cousteau.
Oh, you know who he reminds me of? George Reed. George was one of the actors at Star Trek. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he had a very distinct accent, very similar to that Andorian's.
He would have made a perfect Andorian.
Would have made a great Andorian. But that guy seems very calm and rational, which, as we find out later, is not really, you know, a quality of many Andorians. And then the fake Andorian, Taleb, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
He gives all Andorians a bad rep for decades.
He does.
That guy, I mean, the one thing that people...
He was a lion.
Yeah.
Right. But people don't remember that. The people that are not big Trek fans but have seen that, the one thing that they take away from that episode is that one of the Andorians had a fake antenna. They don't remember that he actually wasn't an Andorian. They just remember that he was a sneaky spy, you know? Trust me, I know this because Commander Tarin had to put up with so much crap from Kingskins asking her if her antenna were fake. And she was very, very annoyed about that. The fact that this guy ends up being an Orion is pretty funny. I guess green and blue are close to each other on the color wheel. I don't know. But
He just had to add, he just had to take yellow out of his skin. That's
there awesome. You go. But yeah, and one of the great things about the series Enterprise is that it really did expand our knowledge of Andorians. And I'm kind of grateful to them because they helped me to bring Commander Tarin to life. I actually patterned her. Not entirely, but largely after Susie Plaxton's character, Tara.
Our friend Susie.
Yes, she's awesome. And she was not a particularly pleasant character, you know, a bit, shall we say, cranky. And that's what Tarin was, too. You know, she was unhappy, cranky, and loud. But people loved her anyway.
So while we're on the subject, would you be able to share with us any of your most favorite Tarin moments?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know about favorite, but when I first became Tarin, what they gave me was this big long wig. I started out with this long white wig, and it kind of looked like stripper hair, you know? So I got grabbed and mauled. I can't even tell you how many times guys would come up behind me and, you know, just grab me.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. And finally, I asked for different hair. I said, I look like a doll. I look like a toy. And so they gave me a much better wig, shorter. And, you know, I looked like I could really kick some butt in that wig. And that I think, is when Tarin really came into her own, when she got shorter hair. And yeah, nobody grabbed me after that. They were kind of intimidated by me, which was great. You know, I just walked around there, or she just walked around there with a swagger most of the time and acted like she owned the place. But yeah, she had commanded a ship, the Imperial warship Shran. But due to circumstances that I guess she didn't really want to discuss, she lost that command. That's something to do with the violation of the Andorian Code of Honor. And then she ended up serving on the time station, a place she did not want to be. So her entire time on that time station, she was trying to get off. So
I would like to point out that through no small effort of my own, April is the proud owner of a Barbie doll from Mattel.
That's
it,
right.
It is the only Barbie doll in existence. It's run one of one of Barbie as Tarin,
nice.
Which was made by the R&D department there at Mattel. I have an ex-girlfriend and at the time and some friends who worked there and put that together for her for her birthday back in 2009.
Wow. Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
What? Some nice friends or what? Man, that was a great present.
That's pretty awesome. Do you think you could furnish us with a picture of that, April?
I would be glad to.
Oh, that's so awesome. We're really glad. We'll post that up with the episode when we put it up. So, Vernon, while we're talking about this, do you have any Tarin memories that you can share? Any stories?
Well, I want to point out that her, as well as Kastran, who was played by our friend Kirsten, their antenna, We're Michael Westmore antenna, straight from the Enterprise Andorian molds. adding some legitimacy to their makeup and their character. God, what would my, I guess my favorite Andorian moment on the floor would be out there at Star Trek The Experience, was that Kirsten as Kestran had this deadpan look.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't even look him in the eyes. And April was out there. It was after work. I was just sitting in the bar having a drink at Quark's. And there's T'Pril out on the floor, which is April's
Vulcan character. Vulcan character, right. Not Tyrell.
Right. She's Vulcan. So, you know, Vulcan's no emotion. They're laughing. Well, in walks Kestran, which is Kirsten as an Andorian. And he's, while T'Pril is talking to me, and I'm sitting there at the bar having my drink, he's just standing behind her. She realizes someone's behind her and looks him in the eyes and then starts to lose it and gets off the floor really quickly because the Vulcan's going to start laughing. I think that was my favorite Andorian moment on the floor.
That's pretty funny. I could picture. Do you remember that, April?
Oh, yeah. You know what? He did that to me a couple of times.
And all he has to do is look at you. Just look
at
you.
Yes, and he's got a look. I don't even know how to describe it, but I would just try so hard not to bust up because, you know, I was a Vulcan because he and I, there were never two Andorians on the floor. Basically, we talk smack about each other, you know, when we were on the floor as our Andorian characters. He hated his character, hated my character hated his character. So all we did was talk smack. So we were never in the same room at the same time. So when he was on the floor as an Andorian, I was the Professor T'Pril. And it was his life's work to bust me up. So.
That's awesome. So, April, do you have any favorite fan interactions as Taryn?
Oh, man. I don't know. A lot of people, like you said, didn't really know who I was. You know, they knew that I was something with Star Trek, and they recognized the antenna, but they didn't know what I was, you know? So I got a lot of expository time in there because they wanted to know. They were very, very curious about Andorians, you know? So I did a lot of talking with people on the floor. I can't think of any one time that...
What's the girl's name who patterned her costume after you? And she came to the Experience as a little girl.
Corinne,
yeah.
Yes.
Who came dressed as you at the convention a couple of years ago.
She came to the Experience before she was like 9 or 10 or whatever, and she came with her dad. And then like 10 years later, she shows up at the convention as, you know, she wasn't Taryn, but she had patterned everything, her costume, her makeup, everything. She patterned it after me. And I got to meet her, and she was just thrilled to death to meet me, you know, and talked about how she, you know, had just idolized the character. And when she decided to be an Andorian, she knew who she wanted to pattern it after, you know. So she did a great job. Her uniform looked great. Her makeup looks good. Yeah, she definitely got it.
And that's also, again, illustrates how important the Experience was and is, and why it should rightfully be considered a part of Star Trek canon.
Thank you. Yeah, well, plus so many people that worked on, you know, all the Star Trek series, so it's not like we just pulled it out of a hat or anything. Definitely.
And Commander Taryn has sort of lived beyond the Experience as well, huh?
Yeah, you should post a link to her little foray back into the 21st or 20th century here. Yeah, she's very unhappy because she's stuck here. She went back through the wormhole after the time station was decommissioned, but due to Kestran, she ended up back here. Yeah, pretty funny.
There's a sequel in the works, too.
Oh, excellent. Oh,
very cool. We're looking forward to that. You know, I wanted to quickly ask you guys, since we're talking a little bit about your characters at the Experience, you guys are going to be doing some panel work at the upcoming convention in Vegas?
Yeah, I'm not sure what day we are scheduled. I haven't really seen a schedule or if there even is one yet, but we are going to be on a Star Trek The Experience panel along with some other people. And Larry Nemechek is going to be there with us. And the whole point is we're not going to talk about, well, we might talk about how awesome it was for us. But the whole point of that panel is what Star Trek The Experience meant to our guests and the people that visited us. And so we've got some like special guests who have been our guests in the past and are going to talk about, you know, the really important things in their life that happened because of coming to the experience. A lot of really, really cool things are going to happen during that panel.
Oh, excellent. We're looking forward to that.
Yeah, we will be there. We have our reserved seats ready.
I am so excited.
That's going to be awesome.
I'm so glad. I'm glad you guys are going to be there for that.
Oh, we can't wait. So before we close out our section on the Andorians, I wanted to mention that as with other alien races that were introduced on the original series, and I would be absolutely remiss if I didn't bring up the Gorn in this situation. I know Craig will be very happy that I brought the Gorn up again. But the Andorians appeared about four times in the original series, twice in the animated series, twice in the Next Generation, and about 15 times in Enterprise. So it seems like there's a bit of an imbalance here, the same as there is an imbalance with other alien races that were brought into the original series. I just wanted to throw it out there if anybody has any comments to make on the relative imbalance of Andorian appearances in the original series. Go ahead and throw them out there.
Well, I think they realized how awesome the Andorians were and that they should be featured. That's all I'm saying.
There you go.
I think it's a lot like the Ferengi from the first season of TNG. The Ferengi were kind of a failure, and they didn't want to use them anymore until some talented people figured out what to do with that type of character. And I think by Enterprise, they had finally figured out what to do with the Andorian character. Up until then, it had just been a nod whenever Andorians were shown, a nod to the original series.
Yeah, and but it was always to look at, so...
Yeah,
they were really interesting.
I think we would have gotten more Andorians in the original series if it wasn't for budgetary constraints. I believe it was the most expensive alien makeup there was for aliens at the time.
That seems to fit the bill. Chris, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I think a big reason you got a lot of the Andorians in Enterprise as well was because of the actor who played Tran, Jeffrey Combs. He was just great actor. He also played Wayun Dvorda in Deep Space Nine as well as Liquidator Brunt. And every time he was on an episode, it would just be fantastic. The guy's a great actor. And as Tran, he was fantastic.
Agreed. Yeah.
He, along with Vaughn Armstrong, Susie Plaxton, and a number of actors, are the best things that happened to the Star Trek franchise, where there's these recurring actors they would use in multiple roles. He's definitely one of them, if not the best.
Yes.
Great stuff. Craig Cohen, anything?
No, I'm still just sitting back and enjoying this, the input of our three super panelists.
Super panelist.
So we've worked through the Andorian section of the show, and we will move on to the Tellarites. Now, the Tellarites were another race introduced in Journey to Babel. They were a stout humanoid species with a distinctive snouts, almost pig-like, I guess, in the original series. They changed a bit after the original series into a more human nose that was a little exaggerated. They wore beards, and their hands were sometimes hoof-like in appearance. So they kind of looked like a cross between, in the original series anyway, they looked like a cross between a dwarf, maybe from Lord of the Rings, and a little like a pig guy or something like that. So I'm going to open up the floor to general impressions on the Tellarites. So April, any thoughts?
Well, you know, with that piggy nose and the little beady eyes and the hairy faces and the bad temper, basically, I just think that they were designed and written to be unlikable and be unrelatable to humans, you know? So I think they did that so that you really can't feel sorry when, you know, gets killed. They find him dead and nobody's sorry.
No. I mean, upside down in a Jeffrey's tube, not a way we all want to go.
They were a little bit curious, but nobody went, oh, that's a tragedy.
No, they didn't, did they? Chris Ritzer, thoughts on Tellarites?
Oh, yeah, they're total pricks, and they're always combative. They're always arguing, and it's great. They carried that right through to Enterprise as well. They were constantly causing trouble and stirring things up. They're great.
All right. Vernon.
I almost married a girl back in my California years who I swear must have been a Delorite, because it's all she wanted to do was argue, and she got fat after a number of years. And I'm not going to throw out any names, but, I got to say, the Tellarites, unlike the Andorians, they hadn't been brought back until Enterprise. And when they did, Michael Westmore is such a genius when it comes to segueing makeup into the modern series. Those horrible eye cutouts they had on the original masks in Journey to Babel were worked in to the Michael Westmore makeup scheme for Enterprise and kind of explained, okay, well, that wasn't a horrible eye cutout. That was just an extra rim around their eye. Now you can see it closer and more sharply, and that explains that. He did a great job legitimizing the original look of the Tellarites.
Vernon, can I just say that you could probably have a great stand-up comedy act talking about your ex-girlfriends?
She's an endless source of material. Endless source.
You always have some great stories for us about your exes when we talk to you. So, Craig Cohen, thoughts on Tellarites?
Yeah, I mean, just to expand on thoughts regarding unused and untapped characters in Star Trek, it's great that they were introduced here and were able to be sort of cherry-picked for future series because there's definitely a lot of potential there.
No, I agree. So I'm going to throw this out there because something that Craig and I brought up on the our commentary episode from Journey to Babel. Now, the Tellarites, they have that kind of pig-like look, and we sort of theorized that they inspired some Star Wars characters in a way. Craig suggested that the
Ugnaughts.
The Ugnaughts. Not only just the Ugnaughts, but there was the villain character in the cantina. I guess that Obi-Wan cut his arm off. He was kind of pig-like looking.
Dr. Evazan or Mr. Ugly, depending on which version of canon you go with. His nose came from the concept, which I believe was done by Rick Baker, of taking a human nose and cutting it in half and turning one side upside down.
Ah, okay.
That's interesting. So we've got Ugnaughts, and we've also got, the Gamorrean guards?
Oh, yeah, they're total pigs.
There you go. So we got some Tellarites in Star Wars. So once again, there's an imbalance, a seeming imbalance that Vernon alluded to, where the Tellarites appeared in two original series episodes, one animated series episode in which they didn't really look all that Tellarite-ish to me, and in 8 episodes of Enterprise. So anybody have any thoughts on the imbalance of appearances on Tellarites?
I don't think I have anything else on Tellarites.
Okay.
Well, I just can't figure out how they ended up as founding members of the Federation.
Yes.
Yeah, really. Why'd they let them in?
How did that happen?
I think that's a Roddenberry influence. I think he's what Star Trek is saying there is that you can take the most disagreeable line of species and have them be part of something that's grand and better for the whole, that you need even that negative influence in your mix to make the thing work.
Wow, that is deep, Vernon. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I've been drinking, so it's all gone out.
What have you been drinking, Vernon?
I am having a rum and Coke Zero.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Romulan Ale and Coke Zero.
But, if I could get some, I'd be drinking it. It's hard to come by these days.
Oh, well, maybe we can get you some blue Curacao and mix it up with something else, and we can call it Romulan Ale.
Oh, this reminds me of some guy at the bar took a shine to Ta Rin and tried to buy her a drink, and she said she didn't drink that human swill. So he made the bartender mix the silver tequila and blue curacao together and put it in shot glass.
Didn't that become a standard drink at Quark's after that?
That's Andorian ale.
Cool.
Yeah. So it was some guy trying to hit on Ta Rin.
Nice. Well, they'll put up the recipe for that.
Well, I think it's one part tequila and one part blue curacao or something of that nature. I have no idea.
Oh, wow.
That's
I'd like to point out that they, when they were making drinks, whenever they invented something new on the menu at the experience, they would ask the employees, hey, what should we name this or what should we make this out of? And when they were coming up with a Borg drink to herald the Borg invasion attraction opening there, they asked us, Borg, hey, what do we name this green drink that's going to be Borg-themed? Which ended up being called the Borg Sphere, which is pretty cool because it was served in the sphere. But my suggestion was that we call it the Omega Particle, which is the holy grail for Borg, you know, and it kind of looked like one. But I got shot down. So I'm going to invent a drink and call it the Omega Particle, and I'm going to pass the recipe around at the convention this year.
There you go.
That sounds like a great idea. I hope everybody will pardon me for a minute. I just had an idea to break a little bit of format here and take an aside from Journey to Babel for a second and reference something that Craig and I talked about during the iMUD episode, since Vernon just brought up the Borg. And I know Vernon was a Borg character in the Star Trek experience. And during our iMUD episode, Craig and I started to talk about the fact that we thought that the androids in the iMUD episode would have made a perfect basis for a Borg origin story. Vernon, have you ever thought about that? It just seemed like they would have been such a perfect beginning for the Borg.
It does sound good, except for that the androids in iMUD were complete androids, not biomechanical.
Right, right.
But there's all kinds of references. If you read, what is it called? Shatner wrote a novel, or paid someone to write a novel. I forget what it's called, but...
The Return?
It ties... Thank you. Yeah. It ties Spock's mind meld with Beeger into the Borg Collective, that the machine planet Beeger ended up at was the Borg homeworld in the Delta Quadrant. And they're the ones who built this thing to go back to Earth and, you know, gather information. But there's a ton of starter points in Star Trek where you could attribute it to the Borg through the expanded universe or whatnot. But as far as the androids and iMUD go, I wouldn't attribute that to anything more than, say, something of the work of someone similar to Dr. Sung ending up on a planet creating androids or something. Not a good jumping off point for the Borg.
Oh, okay, interesting. And shot that theory right out of the water.
Sorry about that.
Thanks, Vernon. It's been nice talking to you.
No, but that's what makes Star Trek so great is you can have discussions like that. I don't know. I think it's something really, really kind of neat about the fandom.
Star Trek is such a rich canon that you could debate it forever.
Oh, I agree. And speaking of debates, you know, while we're here and on this topic, maybe we can get Vernon and April's opinion on this. Is that why does it seem like androids in the original series always seem to look more realistic than Data?
Yes. I think Dr. Sim was more concentrated on function than form.
Interesting.
And Data, when he created Lol, obviously he got past that point. I love the three-parter in Enterprise where we see Erickson, his grandfather or great-grandfather, starting out with, you know, genetics, which relates to the eugenics wars, and then at the end of all that, deciding to concentrate on artificial life forms.
Yeah, plus in the original series, weren't most of the androids hot women? So, you know.
Hey, don't get down on Andrea.
Enough said. I think that's why. Guys created them. Oh, that's all I'm saying.
Except for Mud's wife.
Well, that's...
She wasn't very hot.
Yeah, I should have one of those recreated of my ex-fiancée from California so that I could tell her to shut the hell up. You know what? I'll take a cue from Mud and do that.
We're bringing 500 copies of her to Vegas with us.
I was just going to say, be careful. You might get more than you need or want.
That's great. So wrapping back around the Journey to Babel, we were tying up our conversation on Tellarites. So any final thoughts on Tellarites from anybody on the panel before we move on?
I think we said everything there is to say about Tellarites.
Yeah.
Okay.
Only to say the best Tellarite episode is Bounty, where Archer is bountied by a Tellarite to the Klingon Empire, which takes place just before the whole Zindi conflict thing. to kind of resolve that subplot of the series. That was probably the best Tellarite performance in all of Star Trek.
Chris, any thoughts on that?
I think it's all been said.
Okay. All right. So let's move along. And, you know, we're going to move on to Vulcans. Now, Vulcans, of course, weren't introduced in Journey to Babel. We've had experience with Vulcans before, but so a very key Vulcan was introduced in Journey to Babel, and that was Sarek, Spock's father. And not only did we get introduced to Sarek, we also got introduced to Spock's mother, and the conflict that's going on between Spock and his father. So that's based on Spock's refusal or forsaking of the Vulcan Science Academy and opting to go into Starfleet instead. And that of course, wasn't really addressed too much more in Journey to Babel, but was kind of fleshed out a little bit more in the 2009 J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboot. I knew that we were going to get some laughter from Vernon on that. How did I know this could happen? Vernon, do you have any input on that?
Oh, well, man.
Okay, I'm not going to get into the whole JJ thing, but I love Ben Cross, and I'm happy he played Sarek. And yes, they were correct to go into that line of thinking when they did that movie. Mm-hmm. Kudos. But getting out of the JJ thing, back in the reality here, when Sarek appeared only... Now, Mark Leonard appeared three times in the series, once as Romulan, twice as Sarek. Oh, wait, back up. I'm sorry. He appeared as Sarek once in the series, and so did Amanda. But just for those brief moments they appeared in the series, when I was in the theater in 1984 seeing Star Trek III, and Sarek walks into Kirk's apartment, the audience stood up and cheered, which, you know, that tells you what this character and that actor meant to the franchise. And the same thing in Star Trek IV, when Amanda walked in, the audience stood up and cheered. And these are characters that appeared only once in the series, but it shows you how important they are to the fans. Those two actors did magnificent jobs, and the writers, I believe, in fact, I can back this up with a couple of documentaries, Journey to Babel is Leonard Nimoy's favorite episode, simply because of that fact. His parents are in the episode.
Awesome.
Yeah, and now that kind of reminds me of a piece that I had read not long ago that said that during that period of the original series, they received a huge amount of fan mail addressed to Mark Leonard, and it kind of eclipsed the fan mail that was sent to Leonard Nimoy. So I think that speaks to the importance of the Sarek character.
Absolutely, and his two appearances in TNG were just the best thing that the creators of that show could have possibly done. The episode dedicated to Sarek, and then, of course, his appearance in Unification. That Agreed. Was one of the best things they could have ever done.
Agreed. Chris Ritzer, thoughts on Sarek and Amanda in general?
I think Sarek should have gone to the doctor a little more often, because every time he popped up, he was always sick.
He ate a few too many hamburgers.
Oh, I also think it was pretty cool. They actually brought him into the animated series as well for, what was the episode, Yesteryear?
Yeah, Spock's childhood, right?
Yeah, that was impressive. They actually were able to get Mark Leonard to do the voice work for that.
Oh, yeah, good bring up.
Yeah, everybody got to do voice work on that show except Walter.
He got the right one, though.
He wrote one, which I believe was the... Well, no, that was DC Fontana. God, what did he write? More Tribbles, More Troubles?
No, he wrote the one where they're the giant clone of Spock, right?
You know, as much as fans bellyache about the animated series and it not being considered canon and stuff, I'll take that over the JJ universe any day. And stuff in the Yesteryear resonated on into Enterprise. You had the Salot and the Forge and all that three-part episode on Vulcan. That all came from Yesteryear.
Nice. I can always leave it to Vernon to get the dig in on JJ.
Try not to go there.
No, one day we aspire to get Vernon and JJ on the show at the same time.
I get hate mail for being a JJ hater. And I don't hate JJ. He made a wonderful television series, Lost. I loved it, except for the end. And I was excited when I found out he was in charge of Star Trek. But, like, when I went to go see The Phantom Menace in 1999, I was completely let down and went home crying.
Okay, let's. Now that we brought up the Phantom Menace, we've hit a new low on the tricorder transmissions.
Let's not to get too into the JJ Star Treks, but I think the main problem, Vernon, is, and we might have talked about this before, is they went from making a movie for Star Trek fans to a movie that could appeal to every demographic so they could hit the box office number that they needed to hit.
Sure, and the argument is, even if Trekkies don't like these two films, it's bringing in new fans to watch all the original material. But I'll tell you what J.J. and his writers did from the onset. They took Star Trek, the whole 40-year canon, minced it up into little pieces and put it in a blender, and said, hey, well, this has elements of Star Trek in it, and we slapped it together in a liquid that doesn't make sense. So drink it! Drink it, fans!
All right, Vernon, can you know, while we're here, we've descended into this quagmire. So I remember when we were in Las Vegas and we were hanging out with you and April. April told a story about how you walked out on a JJ Star Trek movie. Would you refresh us on that, please?
That was the Star best Trek. Thing that ever happened in the movie theater.
Well, should I let you tell that one, April?
No, you tell it.
Well, okay, all right. Yeah, God, the anticipation of Into Darkness, which is a perfect title for that movie, is coming up that who is the bad guy? We don't get who the bad guy is. What happens to relate to Star Trek? And then the rumors start coming up that he's Khan. And I'm like, there's no way this skinny British kid could be Khan, so that's not right. And then halfway through the film, I pick up on their little clues, the 72 canisters and the so on and so forth, and I'm thinking, oh, shit, this guy's going to be Khan. And then finally, the scene halfway through the film, and I'm seeing this film with my two colleagues, April and Nicole, both actresses from Star Trek The Experience, and Nicole starts to see it in my face. Oh, he's figured it out, and he's getting angry. And as soon as the part comes up where Cumberbatch has the close-up and he says, my name is Khan, I threw my popcorn up into the air and I said, I'm done. And I walked out of the theater and I went to the bar and I had some drinks and I did some gambling. And the whole theater, apparently in my absence, is roaring and laughing. And
they loved it. They loved it. They laughed and people were going, don't go.
I did go back to see it another time and watch the whole thing. In fact, I have the Blu-ray because a friend of mine at work bought me the Blu-ray thinking I would like it. I was very gracious. Thank you.
And that'll be added to Netflix within the next couple of days.
Cool. So we'll bring an iPad down and we can all watch it together when we're in Vegas. And Vernon can throw popcorn.
Yeah, you have to bring some popcorn so he can recreate that because it was a thing of beauty. It was so fabulous, and it was so well-timed, and it was so funny because he had stayed away from all the, you know, the hoopla, so he really, it was a total surprise to him. Well, maybe not a total surprise, but it was, you know, he was just, it was a totally natural reaction.
There's only one other movie I've ever walked out on, and that was Lost in Space, and I was on a date with a girl who didn't know any better. And when it got to I was suffering through it, but when the part came where the purple animated monkey kissed Matt LeBlanc like Bugs Bunny, I did the same thing. I threw my popcorn in the air and I said, well, I'm done. Where are you going, Vernon? I'll be in the bar.
All right, Craig, make a note. We need to start seeing movies with Vernon.
Yeah.
This sounds awesome to me.
I'm not afraid to walk out of a movie that sucks. I'm not afraid.
So, April, any thoughts on Sarek and Amanda in general?
Well, okay. Well, this is not about Sarek per se, but
no.
I just don't understand how Kirk could not know who Spock's parents are. How is that possible? I mean, I understand that it was a dramatic moment and that's why they did it. But really, how could he not know that his first officer's father was an ambassador?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Spock obviously kept it a secret. In the pilot episode with Kirk and Spock, which is Where No Man Has Gone Before, they refer not to his parents, but to an ancestor being human. So obviously Spock never told Kirk the whole story there. He was keeping it private.
It just seems like something that everybody would know, you know?
You would think. I mean, you know, we've seen the computer on the Enterprise in prior episodes do some incredible facial recognition work. So you would think it has some sort of database of pictures. And now Kirk could have easily looked up Spock's parents, right?
Absolutely.
Because it identified Harry Mudd, right? It knew when Harry was lying about who he was. So obviously the computer is pretty intelligent with faces.
Well, obviously, like I said, it was done for dramatic effect, and it was very dramatic. But in reality, I can't imagine that happening. But Sarek, well, I love Amanda. I love her. She understands the Vulcan way, you know, and she just kind of goes through all their drama between the father and the son, and she's a very human person. So I appreciate her. But
very unlike Winona Ryder, yeah.
You got to keep going there.
He's never going to stop. He's never going to stop. But yeah, the whole idea of Vulcans being non-emotional, this episode really kind of points out that that is not indeed the case, you know, because if, as Sarek says, offense is a human emotion and he doesn't take offense, of course he takes offense. Why is he so butthurt over Spock, you know?
Jeff brought that up in our commentary, how there seems to be a disconnect with the logic there.
Yeah, well, the whole upshot of that is that Professor T'Pol was very well aware, is that Vulcans are as emotional, perhaps more so, than humans are. So their whole psyche is striving to overcome it, but they're still susceptible to feelings as any human. But they work really hard to subordinate it to logic. But in the end, it's pretty much all an act.
Wow.
So,
Roddenberry showing hypocrisy.
That is not
hypocrisy. Or, well, okay, at the very least, irony.
Okay, irony is great, though. Yeah, but when we get to the, you know, the origin of Vulcans, you know, and the disconnect between Vulcans and Romulans and the fact that they were an extremely violent race who almost destroyed themselves, then this all makes perfect sense, which isn't, I mean, we don't know this here, you know, But yeah, it makes perfect sense that they would be extraordinarily emotional. And so from the time they're born, they're taught to suppress that, because if they don't, they could destroy themselves.
Wow. As much as I want to address April saying the word butthurt, I want to give Craig an opportunity to talk a little bit about Sarek and Amanda. We'll come back to the butthurt thing in a minute.
Yeah, I think the cool thing about this aspect of the episode is, as much as it's been illustrated prior to this that's, you know, Spock's got this duality that he's fighting all the time, this really illustrated it in a perfect way, and really, you know, helped showcase Spock's struggle. And it's definitely an important moment in the series, and the introduction of two important characters who, like Vernon said, weren't seen a lot, but had a huge impact on the Star Trek fandom.
Awesome. Awesome. Well said. Well
Thank
said.
You.
Chris, any thoughts from you?
I think we just about hit all the points on it.
Okay. All right. So moving on. So I have an observation that I had made while I was watching The Journey to Babel. And honestly, I don't know if I picked up on this in my prior watches of that episode. I'd seen it many, many times over the years. But during the episode, we see this several times between Sarek and Amanda. They have that two-finger, the forefinger and middle finger gesture where they touch their fingers together. And I assume that's either an expression of love or companionship. And as a testimonial to the continuity that some of the writers used when they went on to write later episodes and the movies. We see that used again in Star Trek III between Savick and the young Spock on the Genesis planet when he's going through Pon Farr. They have this almost a ceremonial rubbing together of the forefinger and middle finger of the man and the Vulcan woman together. And I thought that was really neat because we'd seen the Vulcan salute, the live long and prosper gesture before. And this was the genesis of a second Vulcan symbolic gesture. So, April, did you ever have to use that gesture in your character?
No, but let me tell you that occasionally guys would come up and make that signal.
No.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And, I would say to them that I'm not mated to them. And that's a very intimate act. And which, it was certainly in the Pon Farr scene. That is a very intimate moment that we are, watching. But the way that it's shown in Journey to Babel is a little bit not quite so intimate. I mean, they're doing it in front of everybody else, So it's more like, yes, she who is my wife, and this is the symbol of our connection to each other. But yes, I did get offered many of the time.
Vernon, thoughts on the love gesture?
I've tried it. It's not very satisfying.
Were you ever able to do that as a Borg?
No. No, but there were worse things done to me as a Borg on the floor. I can't even get into for public. There was a middle-aged woman once who thought I was a statue because I was standing in retail staring at some merchandise. Thought I was a Borg statue and made some pretty intimate connections that when I moved, finally, it freaked her out.
Wait, so she was using her fore and middle fingers somehow?
There were fingers involved.
Oh, this is going downhill fast.
That's all I have to say about that as far as complicity.
Craig Cohen, any thoughts on the Vulcan love gesture?
No, I think it's just a really cool little detail that, really helps add a lot of depth to the race and shows that, the Vulcan race has their, their own set of customs and their own gestures. And it's a little gesture, but it adds a lot to the race.
No, I agree. I thought absolutely. It was really cool.
It's Vulcan intimacy and it's subtle, which is appropriate. And like Leonard Nimoy said in so many Star Trek specials, Vulcans are a hand-oriented people. When it comes to things like the Vulcan neck pinch, the mind meld, all of their energy and their physical toolage comes through their fingers. There's an energy they emit that no other humanoid has, which always makes me angry when you see an episode, there's very few, where you see a human giving somebody a neck pinch because they learned it from a Vulcan. That's just not possible. There's an energy emitted from their fingertips that makes that possible. Data did it to the Sela in Unification, which was completely wrong. But we'll forgive them.
Data's a superhero. He can do anything.
Exactly.
So, Chris Ritzer, any thoughts on the Vulcan love gesture?
Well, I just have to agree with Craig. It's just nice to see Vulcan culture fleshed out a bit. It's always good to get into the minds of Vulcans. They're a lot deeper than they appear on the surface.
So, April, you also played a Vulcan character at Star Trek The Experience, Professor T'Pril, and we've heard you allude to her before. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that character for the audience?
Well, she had actually started out as a Starfleet officer, and she had been assigned to the time station, just like all the other Starfleet officers were assigned to the time station. But at some point, she decided to leave Starfleet and work, as a professor with the Vulcan Science Academy. So what she was doing was field research on the time station, and her specialty was 20th and 21st century humans. She was fascinated by them. And so all her interactions with humans were simply designed to observe them. She would often ask questions of them more so than they of her. She was incredibly curious about humanity. She found it so unique and interesting. And she actually ended up writing a paper, and I can't remember the name of the paper, but it was something like a xenophobia among humanoid species or something like that, about how humans, particularly in the 21st century, were a little bit afraid often of like the Klingons. And so she would watch the interaction between the humans and the other aliens on the time station and observe that as well. So yeah, she's back in the 21st century. She is actually teaching at the Vulcan Science Academy.
Wow, that's awesome. What a great backstory on that character.
Well, I mean, whichever character I was, they had a full, rich life. So, you know, and we had a lot of time to flesh them out, as it were. So people could ask us about our past and our future. And we did know. And it was all in keeping with the Star Trek universe. That's why we made the big bucks. Ha ha.
So any favorite T'Pril stories you could tell us?
Well, there are a couple. I was standing with one of our Klingons, and this man and his little son came up, and the son was very afraid of the Klingon. And the man, which they used to do, you know, when kids would be afraid, they'd say, "Oh, don't worry, they're fake, they're not real." And the little kid looked at both of us and he said, "Well, I know he's fake, but she's not." Really, really pissed off the Klingon. Oh. But yeah, so I apparently was real. And I think that Professor T'Pril was real. I mean, she was real to me. Another thing that that happened was that Professor T'Pril was walking through the bar one day, and she saw this guy sitting at the bar, and he looked a little unhappy. So Professor T'Pril was a bit of a psychologist, and she asked him what the problem was. And he said that, well, he'd moved to Vegas a couple of months ago for a job, but he really was unhappy. And, you know, he just went on for a couple of minutes about how unhappy he was. And she thought for a minute, and she said, "Then why are you here?" And he said, "Oh, I don't know. Anyway, so we went away from each other. And the next day he came back and he came looking for me. And he said, "I just wanted you to know that I decided to quit my job and move back home."
April, yeah. What about when T'Pril neck pinched Quan?
Oh, that was pretty funny. Yeah. So anyway, so she, T'Pril, psychoanalyzed this guy into quitting his job and moving back to his hometown because he wasn't happy here. Yes. And then one time some woman came up to me and she said, "Do the Vulcan neck pinch, do the Vulcan neck pinch." And I said, "I cannot do that. It would be harmful." And she goes, "Oh, you're fake. Do it. And I looked over and Quan, one of our Ferengi, happened to be sitting maybe 2-3 feet from me at the bar. And he wasn't turned in my direction. So he didn't even know I was there. And I said, "Well, all right. It goes a little something like this." And I reached over and I pinched Quan's neck, and just, this is how great he was. He just stood straight up in the chair and then face down, bam, right onto the bar. And the lady was thrilled. She was thrilled. I mean, I never talked to him about that or anything. He just felt my fingers on his neck and he did it.
That's pretty awesome.
That's a tribute. That's a tribute to the actors who played four characters at Star Trek The Experience. They were ready to do anything canon related at any moment, knowing their jobs. And Jared Formby, who played Quan, probably our most entertaining Ferengi, he knew when he might have been involved with something else, but he knew when he felt that neck pinch from T'Pril, who was aware of in his vicinity, he hit the bar and hit the floor and was unconscious for the next 10 minutes.
Yes, he laid there on the floor for several minutes. I don't know about 10, but he laid there for several minutes, and the whole entire bar just erupted in cheers.
That's pretty awesome. Vernon, is that your favorite Tipril story?
That's my favorite Tipril story, yes. I wish I could have been there to witness it. In fact, I wish I could have been there to video it. But, yeah, I've got a lot of favorite floor character stories, but that one, as far as Tipril, stands out the most.
That's great. So, April, any more about Professor Tipril before we move along?
She was, I think she was my favorite character, you know. I mean, I played a lot of different, you know, Starfleet officers and I was Commander Tarin. And the thing about playing two such different characters is that it was very therapeutic because Tarin was just off the chain, you know, she was insane. And Tipril was the complete and total opposite. You couldn't, only Castran could, you know, get her have any emotional response. So she was calm, cool, collected. So I got to play both ends of that spectrum, and it's something that a lot of people don't get to do, you know? So I was very fortunate.
What April's leaving out is during our closing ceremony, the final day of Star Trek Experience, which is on DVD if you have the box set of the original movies, Tipril, which April was playing that night, was presented with the Federation flag, which hung over our atrium or our foyer. The whole 11 years the place was open. She was presented with that at the end of the red carpet ceremony. And that's when April/Tipril broke down into tears, which is on DVD and Blu-ray for all to see, because she was given this marvelous, iconic piece of Star Trek The Experience as a gift for her 11 years of service when the place closed.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's incredible.
I will forever be known as the crying Vulcan, and I'm very proud to be that.
No shame there.
As well you should be.
Yeah.
So that brings us to our roundtable section on Vulcans. And I want to kick this off. I had a couple of thoughts, things that are original series related specifically about Vulcans. And I was going to throw a couple of things out there to the group. The first thing I wanted to throw out there is that, Sarek and Amanda and Captain Kirk have had a couple of interactions over the years, not only in the original series, but in the movies. And Craig and I had thought about this in Amok Time that, as far as the Vulcans knew, Kirk was dead, right? Spock killed him. But it's never mentioned again, right? So Sarek and Amanda both come into contact with Kirk after he supposedly was dead. And they never bring that back up. So I was wondering, do you guys have any thoughts on why they let that slide? I mean, that seems to be a really huge Vulcan ritual that Kirk kind of violated the principles of, right? I mean, he tricked them into thinking that he actually died when he didn't. And wouldn't you think that would be a huge insult in the Vulcan culture?
He's personal.
In my mind. In my mind, it's because Sarek and Amanda were not at, for whatever reason, not at Spock's wedding. They weren't there, which is like, what? But so they weren't there. They weren't aware of the situation. I think that in the days following Amok Time, maybe Kirk contacted the Vulcan High Council and said, sorry about that. I had to trick you to get the hell out of there. And then, Sarek and Amanda, with all their influence, said, you know what? It's a human interaction thing. And T'Pring was trying to, screw everything over with Stahn anyway. So let's just drop the whole thing. Star Trek Justification 101.
I love it. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, it sounds good. Chris, any thoughts on that?
That works.
Okay. Pretty simple. How about you, Craig?
And this is why I love the super panel that we have.
You can explain away anything.
Yeah.
Anything. So
super panel.
The super panel. From now on, we're going to have to get the super panel together on a regular basis. Awesome. So Let's roll around the panel here and talk about any random thoughts on Vulcans in general. Craig Cohen, you get to go first.
I think the Vulcan race is one of the coolest races that Star Trek introduced, just because it offers so much for the actors that are portraying them to do, even when they're not allowed to show emotions. And that's some of my favorite stuff. And with Spock, of course, you have the half human element, which allowed him to do a lot more. But I think it's just such a great race, you know, that, you know, the concept that, you know, emotions were deemed illogical and just a logic based race is really neat. And I think a lot of times people almost wish they could be Vulcan in certain situations, which is kind of, you know, kind of a way to relate to them in what should be kind of an unrelatable way.
Oh, very cool. Awesome. Chris Ritzer, any thoughts?
Yeah, well, like in Droid of Babel, like prior to that, for the most part with Spock, he's always sort of cracking some dry jokes here and there and snarky to the guys. And I always just chalked it up him being like half human, but his pops is just like that. So I guess like father, like son.
That's great.
Good observation. Vernon, thoughts on Vulcans in general?
I think it's a tribute. Vulcans are a tribute to Gene Roddenberry's genius, taking the human condition and fractioning it out into its constituent elements and showing us that emotion, you know, from the human side can't function without logic, showing that Vulcans, who are logically based, cannot function 100% without emotion, that it's a balance of all of these facets that makes the human condition work.
Very interesting observations, very. April, final thoughts on Vulcans?
Sure, and like I said before, that Vulcans have the facade of emotional distance, and they work at it their entire life. And to them, the epitome of life is to totally get rid of all their emotions. But I think most of them don't reach that point. I think about it. They have the Tal Shaya or whatever that's called, you know, however that guy got killed for nonviolent people, Vulcans, yeah. Some very effective ways to kill people. You know, so obviously that is part of their past and something that they have to deal with. And I really think that the family interactions, and frankly, a bit dysfunctional, is indicative of that struggle that they have. Obviously, Spock has more of a struggle because he's got that human DNA in him, you know, so mm-hmm. it's harder for him. But yeah, just that interaction between them showing that struggle to maintain that facade, and that just doesn't always work all that well.
Good point. Now, I'm kind of glad you wrapped up with mentioning Spock's human DNA, because I hope you guys will indulge me yet again with another weird, wacky thought that I had while I was watching Journey to the Babel. And I'm surprised this is something that has never really occurred to me before this, and I wanted to bring it up while we have the super panel here. Now, you know, Star Trek is kind of well known for not bringing up religion. There are very few religious or spiritual references within the original series. They don't talk much about religious holidays. It only comes up every now and then. But something that occurred to me while I was thinking about Spock in general is that, you know, Spock is, of course, half human and half Vulcan. So what are the broader implications of human DNA being compatible with alien DNA? I mean, right on in our real lives, human DNA is only compatible with other humans. What does it mean in a broader sense that humans can procreate with aliens? Does it speak to creationism? Is there something that links us across different planets and galaxies and universes that our DNA is able to combine and produce offspring together? I mean, it just seems like a huge concept to me that this is a much broader implication here than just accepting the fact that Spock has a human mother and a Vulcan father. So, Vernon, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, there was a TNG episode, forgive me if I've got the title wrong, I think it's called Genesis, where Salome Jens plays an ancient alien that from a race who supposedly seeded the entire galaxy with similar DNA, creating humanoids all over the place. That might be an in-universe explanation, but I think what Roddenberry was trying to say is that we're, you know, of course he was trying to say, we're a small part of a larger brotherhood that expands out there into space, into the galaxy, and we're all compatible emotionally, genetically. It's his vision of universality. Is that a real word? Wait a minute.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's what he was trying to say. That we're just a small part of a bigger puzzle out there.
Wow, Vernon, you can diffuse everything I put out there. That's amazing. Anybody else have any thoughts on this idea?
I was thinking of the Enterprise episode where wasn't there a human?
They tried to merge to Paul and Tucker's DNA together to make a baby, which was unsuccessful.
But, right, it was unsuccessful.
As a result of that, they figured out, humans and Vulcans can have children in the future if you manipulate this and do that, and blah, blah, blah.
Okay, so it's not just that they can, you know, procreate. Apparently, they need a little bit of help to do so.
Yeah.
So it's not straight across procreation. That's all I have to say.
No, Craig?
I got to say, in that episode that April's referencing, which is the second to the last episode before the end of the series in Enterprise, when I think that is Connor Trinneer's most magnificent performance, when Elizabeth dies, the baby, and he's in tears. And they mention, you know, very prophetically, that it is possible in the future for humans and Vulcans to reproduce. It just wasn't done right this time. That's, to me, one of the most touching dramatic scenes in all of Enterprise, which is a very underrated series and very good.
Very cool. We'll definitely have to bring that up again in the future. We can have you back on and we can talk about that specifically. That would be really cool. So what I'm taking away from this conversation is that my hopes of procreating with a Gorn have not been dashed.
That is so kinky.
Well, you know, they say green chicks are hot, but they didn't say what green chicks. Got to be green Gorn chicks out there.
So half Orion slave girl and half Gorn Gorion?
Gorion, I like that. That's pretty awesome.
Okay, so I will put this challenge out there now, because it's plenty of time before the convention. Somebody has to come dressed as a Gorion at this year's Las Vegas convention.
Craig will do it. All right, Craig, you're nominated. That's it.
I've got the outfit for you, Craig.
Oh yeah.
And I have lots of green body paint, so.
Oh.
I can't wait.
That wraps up the Vulcan section of our Journey to Babel episode. We're getting towards the end here, and we had a couple of other alien races who were kind of tangentially mentioned or not mentioned, but just pictured in this episode. And the one, I guess, is the Orion race, which, technically speaking, we hadn't seen on the original series yet. Although we did see an Orion slave girl in the pilot, but back in the days when the original series originally aired, that episode did not appear.
Andy Upon Craig.
What's that?
Andy Upon Craig in Whom Guts Destroy.
That's right.
Was that before Journey to Babel?
That was Batgirl. Batgirl playing the Orion slave girl in Whom Guts Destroy.
Yeah, that was in the third season.
Third season, yes.
Right, so we hadn't seen them yet before Journey to Babel. So they were yet a mystery.
Correct. Yes, you are correct.
So so now we've seen an Orion ship, and we've seen an Orion male disguised or surgically altered to be an Andorian. So we have not yet seen the quote-unquote green chick. But I think they did have a still of her in the credits, the end credits, right?
All the time. Her and Baylock, all the time.
Yeah, so that must have been a heck of a mystery back then to see her and have her not be in any episodes, right?
That's right.
Well, yeah. Technically, she does appear in the two-part episode Menagerie.
Oh, that's right.
So fans would have been, you know, casual viewers would have been familiar with that face by watching Menagerie.
Oh, good point. Good point, Vernon. See, diffused me again.
Are they in Menagerie? Is she actually referenced as an Orion slave girl, though?
I believe Kirk's voiceover for the captain's log does say in the setup after the commercial that Vina appeared to Pike as an Orion slave girl. Ooh. A green Orion slave girl, I think, are the exact words.
Ah, right.
Wow. Vernon's original series knowledge is unparalleled.
Well, I could be wrong. You might have to reference this. In fact, which brings me to my next point. April and I have a friend, as many of us in the Star Trek The Experience circuit do, Felix Silla, who is a little person who has played multiple science fiction roles over the years, Twicky in Buck Rogers,
yeah,
and so on and so forth. I believe, I got to back this up by checking the internet when we're done talking, but I think he was one of the two gold fezzed little people in the banquet scene of Journey to Babel. I'm pretty sure Felix said that was him.
Yeah. Possible.
I know one of the other ones was a little person who appeared in The Terror of Tiny Town. I forgot his name, though.
My powers of recall are out the window. I want to say Billy Bartlett, but I know that's completely wrong.
No, I think you're close. I had it as a reference point on my notes for our commentary, and I don't think we got to talk about them, but that name sounds very, very close to what I remember.
Well, if it's not Felix in that scene, he'll just kick my ass at the next gathering we have, and that'll be the end of that.
So a couple of other alien races that appeared in Journey to Babel but were not name-dropped in Journey to Babel, and forgive me if I'm not pronouncing these correctly, but one was the Macusians or Macusians, and possibly the Ethanites. Chris, can you shed some light on these two?
Yeah, Ethanites, yeah, they were the short little gold people.
Oh, with the fezzes on.
Yeah, with the fezzes on, yeah. And I believe the Macusians, they were hanging in the background, I think. They were tall with hoods. I think that's who that was. I'm not sure.
Who's the purple chick?
I was wondering about that. I just noticed her when I did a rewatch yesterday. I have no idea who she is.
The purple chick?
Yeah, yes. Purple chick. Well, maybe they made.
I gotta watch that tonight.
In the remastered editions, maybe they made her purple. I don't know. I don't have the original series, but in the remastered edition, she's very purple. And she's not wearing a lot, so you'll like that.
I'll check that out. Oh, there's two things I want to say about the editing of that episode.
Okay, go ahead.
If you remember in the late 70s, early 80s, the syndication years of those series when they were chopped up into pieces to make more room for commercials, and we didn't get the whole episodes until VHS and DVD came out, I always used to think there are two odd cuts in that episode. One is just before the Tellarite's death in the Jeffrey tube. The other one is the beginning of the fight between Kirk and the Orion spy.
Totally.
Yeah, that totally comes out of nowhere.
Those cuts are odd, and I always attributed those to syndication cutting. But when I got the full versions of those episodes, those cuts are still there. I'm thinking, it's either just bad editing on the editor's part, or there are scenes that were shot that we are not privy to, that have been excised for whatever reason, time or whatever. It just seems to not flow correctly. And I've always wondered, okay, was something shot that would make more sense out of these two scenes? The other thing is, there were only about 30 episodes of Star Trek that were actually scored. The rest of the episodes were tracked, which is where you take music from another episode and slip it in. This, unfortunately, was a tracked episode. It had music, it had wonderful music from Saul Kaplan, from Amok Time, and from Doomsday Machine, with a couple of other things slipped in between, which were all added appropriately, but were chopped up horribly with bad segues.
Yeah, I think they used some of that Jerry Fried music as well.
Exactly, yeah. And I always thought that's something during the revision process when they were making the special editions, maybe we could go through and at least make the music and the transitions make a little bit more sense. But I think at this point that's something left for the fan editor to do.
Yeah, that's funny you mentioned it, because that's one of the things that Craig and I called out during our commentary was the transition between, I think it's Spock walking out of a room and cutting immediately into the fight scene between Kirk and the false Andorian. It's kind of like a whoa.
There's no setup.
No, not at all. And then you see Kirk do that really weird jump against the wall drop move that he does.
It works.
I guess.
You know what, though? That's a great Shatner moment when he's on the wall comm. Security. Oh, and then he passes out. Great Shatnerism.
Oh, totally.
And something was completely overlooked in the entire episode. A magnificent performance by DeForest Kelly as McCoy. Had some of the best dialogue and acting in that episode compared to anything else, especially when he's pitching at Kirk for shaking the ship so much while he's trying to do the surgery. That's a great McCoy episode.
It really is.
It's easy to overlook with all the other stuff going on. That's an excellent thing to point out for people to look for.
Here in Vegas, when you play the Star Trek slot machines, which are still here and have been here since 2007, a lot of the vocals and visuals that come up on the slot machine video are from Journey to Babel, and including when you get all the McCoys in the center bar, a teddy bear, which, you know, actually, I think those slot machines are very Journey to Babel oriented.
I'm so glad that you wrapped this down to McCoy, because this is going to be a great way to close this conversation out. And something that Craig and I talked about during the commentary, but I'm going to bring this up to all of us. And Journey to Babel, the end of Journey to Babel, is one of two instances in the original series where supposedly the fourth wall was breached. The first one,
oh, yes.
The first one was during The Changeling, when Uhura was being retrained and she's reading off of a computer screen, looks directly into the camera and says, Bluey? Supposedly that breaks the fourth wall. And at the end of Journey to Babel, when McCoy says, well, what do you know? I finally got the final word, or the last word. He's supposedly looking directly into the camera, which is, quote unquote, a fourth wall break. Now, I don't necessarily see that as a fourth wall break. I assume that he was talking to somebody off camera. But what do you guys think? Do you think this is an official fourth wall break in Star Trek?
In Uhura's case, she was looking directly into the camera. But we can attribute that to her being spacey and looking out into nothingness. In McCoy's case, in Journey to Babel, if you watch carefully, he is looking slightly off to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely the chapel.
Yeah. Just saves them from breaking the fourth wall. It could have been, directed towards chapel. And again, another overlooked character. Chapel was great and integral in that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And a little cheeky, too.
Yeah. Yeah, just a little bit. Chris, what do you think about the fourth wall break? Do you think it qualifies?
No, I don't think it qualifies. Yeah, I think he's definitely talking to Chapel.
April?
I agree. I didn't see that as a break at all. I mean, it didn't look all Ferris Bueller to me, So, no, he's not. I don't think he's looking directly at the camera. But
Nurse
Nurse Chapel was awesome in that episode, and she had high hair too. I'm just throwing that out there.
Definitely. So nobody was as high as Janice Rand, but they all tried.
That is true.
So that kind of brings us to a closing point of this extended episode. So I'll open up the floor one more time to everybody for some final thoughts on Journey to Babel or anything Journey to Babel related. So, April, do you have any final thoughts to share on this?
Just that this is a prime example of an excellent original series episode. Like I said, I think it really is character driven, and we learn so much more about particularly the Vulcans than we knew up to that point. And it's a great episode.
All right. Vernon, anything from you?
When it comes to Star Trek, the most successful episodes are involved the triumvirate, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And Kirk and Spock both having very strong egos. McCoy is egoless and is humble and somehow, ironically, is the most badass character in the original series. And when he does something like breaking the fourth wall and saying, what do you do? I finally got in the last word. We can forgive him because he's badass.
Awesome. Chris Ritzer, final words.
Yeah, this is one of my five favorite episodes. You get a great performance from the big three. Mark Leonard does a great job as Sarek. The introduction of the founding fathers of the Federation. You get a little bit of everything. It's just great.
Agreed.
Craig Cohen, final words.
I think this discussion has proven what a great episode this is. And I think our super panel did an excellent job illustrating and vocalizing a lot of the things that make this episode great. And I really look forward to the times that we can gather the super panel together again for more discussions, because this was a lot of fun for me and I'm sure the audience as well.
Yeah.
Well, I had fun.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, like Samuel Jackson said at the end of The Avengers, they'll come back when they're needed again.
Guys, I got to say that I reiterate Craig's comments, and I'm so glad that we were finally able to get April and Vernon together on the show again. We've had them both separately, but this is the first time we've had them back together again. And we've joined them with Chris, who's been on our show a bunch of times. So this has been a long time in the making. And I really, really hope that we can do this again sometime in the near future.
Anytime.
You guys are all awesome. Awesome.
Yes, oh, fantastic. Man. Thanks.
That's great. Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate everybody being here. And does anybody have anything that they'd like to plug or tell anybody in our audience where to find them on social media? April, anything?
Well, I'm at April Abair on Twitter if you want to follow me. You could also follow Commander Ta-Ryn.
Oh.
At Commander Ta-Ryn. She doesn't tweet a lot because she's usually stuck in a freezer somewhere. It's a long story. if you want to friend me on Facebook, just April Abair, H-E-B-E-R-T is my last name. Let me know that you heard about me on Tricorder Transmissions, and I will be your friend.
Oh, awesome. Vernon, any place people can find out more about you and what you're doing?
Yes, please go to Facebook and look up Star Trek My Experience, which is the homepage for my documentary series about Star Trek, The Experience, and a meeting place for guests and alumni of Star Trek, The Experience to meet and chat about their past experiences and get updates about my documentary series, which right now is on hiatus and you can't find it anywhere online, but I am retooling and planning to get it back out there both on the internet and on DVD. Star Trek, My Experience at Facebook.
Awesome. Excellent. Thanks so much for that, Vernon. Chris, anything people can locate you online or?
Nah, if they want, hit up one of the local bars in Philly. I'll probably be around.
I'll meet you at Standard Tap.
Sounds good.
All right. So,
I can't wait to see you guys at Con. That's going to be awesome.
Oh, yes, we can't wait to.
Very excited about that.
It's going to be fantastic. So for the listening audience out there, if you'd like to catch up with us on social media, we are on Facebook at facebook.com/TriquarterTransmissions, on Twitter at TTT_pod, and we also have our own website, thetriquartertransmissions.com. And thanks always for listening to the show, and we'll be back again on Sunday with another regular episode. And thanks again to our awesome super panel. And hopefully we'll all be
super
back again.
Panel.
That's going to be my new text message tone versus Vernon yelling super panel.
I'll give you a clean one after the recording.
Oh, awesome. Sounds good. All right. Thanks again, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you again really soon.
Bye.
Thank you.
Super panel!